The Guardian.
Welcome to The Guardian Long Read, showcasing the best long-form journalism covering culture, politics and new thinking. For the text version of this and all our long reads, go to theguardian.com/longread.
The scientists persuading terrorists to spill their secrets. Expert interrogators know torture doesn't work, but until now, nobody could prove it. By analysing hundreds of top-secret interviews with terror suspects, two British scientists have revolutionised the art of extracting the truth. By Ian Leslie. This article contains strong language. In 2013, a British man was arrested for planning to kidnap and brutally murder a soldier. The suspect, who had a criminal history, had posted messages on social media in support of violent jihad. In a search of his residence, the police had found a bag containing a hammer, a kitchen knife, and a map with the location of a nearby army barracks. Shortly after his arrest, the suspect was interviewed by a counter-terrorist police officer. The interviewer wanted him to provide an account of his plan and to reveal with whom, if anyone, he had been conspiring. But the detainee, we will call him Dialer, refused to divulge any information. Instead, he expounded grandiloquently on the evils of the British state for 42 minutes with little interruption. When the interviewer attempted questions, Dialer responded with scornful finger-jabbing accusations of ignorance, naivety and moral weakness. "You don't know how corrupt your own government is, and if you don't care, then a curse upon you." Watching a video of this encounter, it is just possible to discern Dialer's desire, beneath his ranting, to tell what he knows. In front of him, a copy of the Quran lies open. He says he was acting for the good of the British people, and that he is willing to talk to the police because, as a man of God, he wants to prevent future atrocities. But he will not answer questions until he is sure that the questioner cares about Britain as much as he does. The purpose of the interview is not to go through your little checklist so you can get a pat on the head. If you find you are a Jobsworth, we are done talking, so be sincere. Even distanced by years from the events in question, it is impossible to watch the encounter without feeling tense. Periodically, Dialer turns away from the interviewer and goes silent, or gets up and leaves the room, having taken offence at something said or not said. Each time he returns, Dialer's solicitor advises him not to speak. Dialer ignores him, though in a sense he takes the advice. Despite the verbiage, he tells his interviewer nothing. Dialer: "Tell me why I should tell you. What is the reason behind you asking me this question?" Interviewer: "I'm asking you these questions because I need to investigate what has happened and know what your role was in these events." Dialer: "No, that's your job, not your reason. I'm asking you why it matters to you." The interviewer, who has remained heroically calm in the face of Dialer's verbal barrage, is not able to move the encounter out of stalemate, and eventually his bosses replace him. When the new interviewer takes a seat, Dialer repeats his promise to talk openly and honestly to the right person and resumes his inquisitorial stance. "Why are you asking me these questions?" he says. "Think carefully about your reasons." The new interviewer does not answer directly, but something about his opening speech triggers a change in Dialer's demeanour. "On the day we arrested you," he began, "I believe that you had the intention of killing a British soldier or police officer. I don't know the details of what happened, why you may have felt it needed to happen, or what you wanted to achieve by doing this. Only you know these things, Dialer. If you're willing, you'll tell me. And if you're not, you won't. I can't force you to tell me. I don't want to force you. I'd like you to help me understand. Would you tell me about what happened?" The interviewer opens up his notebook and shows Dialer the empty pages. "You see, I don't even have a list of questions." "That is beautiful," Dialer says. "Because you have treated me with consideration and respect, yes, I will tell you now, but only to help you understand what is really happening in this country." For years, any debate over what constitutes effective interrogation has been dominated by a pervasive folk belief in coercion. From NYPD Blue to 24 and Zero Dark 30, we are trained in the idea that interrogators get the job done by intimidating, demoralizing, and, when necessary, brutalizing their subjects. Stephen Kleinman, a former Army colonel and one of the US military's most prolific and experienced interrogators, told me that it is not just the public that is influenced by popular narratives. Politicians, policymakers, senior military officers, people who have never conducted interrogations are somehow just convinced they know what works. In 2003, Kleinman tried to stop his fellow soldiers from conducting abusive interrogations of Iraqi insurgents. He later became the first military officer to speak out against such practices. He did so not just because he thought they were wrong, but because he thought they were stupid. Kleinman believes that coercion is counterproductive because it destroys the trust that underpins a successful interview. Most specialist practitioners agree, as do the scientists who study interrogation. But conventional wisdom in military and law enforcement circles has been very hard to shift. This is because it is difficult to prove what works. High-stakes interrogations take place in secret and have rarely been available to objective researchers. In place of cool analysis, colourful but unreliable stories of vital secrets wrenched from fearful suspects have prevailed. In reality, well-run interrogations are rarely dramatic. Drama thrives on conflict, something professional interrogators strive to avoid. A body of scientific literature supports Kleinman's view, but most of it is based on laboratory experiments in which students are asked to pretend they have just robbed a bank and interrogators are asked to believe them. The virtue of these experiments is that they allow for controlled trials of specific interrogation techniques. The drawback is that they are easily dismissed by practitioners as academic game-playing. Now, two British researchers are quietly revolutionising the study and practice of interrogation. Earlier this year, in a meeting room at the University of Liverpool, I watched a video of the Dialer interview alongside Lawrence Allison, the university's Chair of Forensic Psychology, and Emily Allison, a professional counsellor. My permission to view the tape was negotiated with the counter-terrorist police, who are understandably wary of allowing outsiders access to such material. Details of the interview have been changed to protect the identity of the officers involved, though the quotes are verbatim. The Allisons, husband and wife, have done something no scholars of interrogation have been able to do before. Working in close cooperation with the police, who allowed them access to more than 1,000 hours of tapes, they have observed and analysed hundreds of real-world interviews with terrorists suspected of serious crimes. No researcher in the world has ever laid hands on such a haul of data before. Based on this research, they have constructed the world's first empirically grounded and comprehensive model of interrogation tactics. The Allison's findings are changing the way law enforcement and security agencies approach the delicate and vital task of gathering human intelligence. I get very little, if any, pushback from practitioners when I present the Allison's work, said Kleinman, who now teaches interrogation tactics to military and police officers. Even those who don't have a clue about the scientific method, it just resonates with them. The Allisons have done more than strengthen the hand of advocates of non-coercive interviewing. They have provided an unprecedentedly authoritative account of what works and what does not, rooted in a profound understanding of human relations. That they have been able to do so is testament to a joint preoccupation with police interviews that stretches back more than 20 years. Pausing the Dialer video, Emily Allison grimaced. I call this one the Hannibal Lecter interview, she said. He wants a piece of the interviewer. When I watched this tape the first time, I had to switch it off and walk away. I was so outraged, my heart was pounding in my chest. Of course, if you're in the room, it's 1,000 times worse. Lawrence Allison nodded. As the interviewer, you're bound to have an emotional response, he said. What you want to say is, you're the one in the fucking seat, not me. He's trying to control you, so try and control him. but then it escalates. The moment that an interrogation turns into an argument, it fails. You need to remember what your purpose in that room is, said Emily. You're seeking information. You're not there to speak on behalf of the victims or the police. You might feel better for getting angry, but down the road is retribution. You become the Inquisitioner. That's not why you're there. If you find yourself having a go at someone, ask yourself, what am I achieving by this? Because they will stop talking to you. With us on the day we watched the video was an officer in Britain's counter-terrorist police force with whom the Allisons have been working closely to train an elite cadre of interviewers. A big thing we talk about is leaving your ego at the door, he said. But that's tough, because cops are used to being in control. Emily met Lawrence at the University of Liverpool in 1996, shortly after arriving in the UK from her home in Wisconsin. She had applied to join the Madison Police Force, which she saw as a stepping stone to the FBI, but opted at the last minute to take a master's in investigative psychology, the application of psychology to police work. Liverpool was then one of the few institutions in the world to offer it. This wasn't long after Silence of the Lambs, said Emily. I wanted to be the new Clarice Starling. Lawrence was a PhD student in the Department of Forensic Psychology and already a rising star after his contribution to a high-profile public inquiry. In 1993, Colin Stagg was wrongfully accused of the rape and murder of a young mother called Rachel Nickell on Wimbledon Common. Despite an absence of forensic evidence linking Stagg to the murder, the police made Stagg their prime suspect after deciding that he matched an offender profile created by a psychologist. A covert operation was designed to entrap Stagg, involving an undercover female police officer feigning romantic interest. After the case was thrown out and the police had acknowledged their mistake, Lawrence assisted the subsequent inquiry by exposing the pseudoscience on which the profile was based. In 2008, a convicted killer called Robert Napper was found guilty of the crime. As part of his research, he watched a video of Stagg's interview conducted by the police at the time of Stagg's first arrest, and he was appalled by what he saw. The interviewers, who had clearly made up their mind that Stagg was guilty, were aggressive, insulting, and asked questions that were not designed to find out what the suspect knew, but to trip him up or intimidate him into confessing. After failing to do either, they released Stagg and decided to entrap him. In 1998, Emily and Lawrence got married. Lawrence continued his academic career. Emily, who had worked as a counsellor in Wisconsin prisons, joined the Cheshire Probation Service and later started a consultancy, helping social workers counsel families afflicted by domestic abuse. Alongside their day jobs, the Allisons started collaborating on criminal cases. Historically, the British police have called on outside experts to help with investigations, but have sometimes ended up listening to quacks. After the Stagg inquiry, however, a list of accredited consultants was drawn up, and Lawrence Allison was on it. Every couple of months or so, he would get a call and a question. It might be, can you help us with this rape in Bath, or a murder in West Mercia, Lawrence said. The police often wanted to know the best way to interview a particular suspect or witness, usually after an initial attempt had gone badly. Lawrence would ask for assistance from Emily, who knew a lot about interviewing difficult people, thanks to her background in counselling. The Allisons would read transcripts, watch video footage, and sometimes monitor interviews in real time, assessing the dynamics of the encounter, searching for a way to get the interviewee to open up. They gained a reputation for offering useful advice. Their first involvement with a counter-terrorist force came in 2004, when they helped police in Northern Ireland investigate the Northern Bank robbery, in which armed raiders, thought to be connected to the IRA, stole £26.5 million from bank vaults in Belfast. In 2010, Lawrence was contacted by a US government agency that was commissioning research into interrogation. The High Value Detainee Interrogation Group, or HIG, was set up in 2009 by President Obama, keen to signal a clean break from the Bush administration, which had sanctioned abusive interrogations in Iraq and Afghanistan. Housed within the FBI, the HIG's purpose is to ground interrogation in science. The last time the US government invested in studying interrogation was 1956, Stephen Kleinman, who works with the HIG, told me. Great leaps forward in behavior science has just passed us by, he said. Imagine using 1956 technology for signals intelligence. One consequence has been the triumph of bad science. In Afghanistan, after the 9/11 attacks, military psychologists Dr. James Mitchell and Dr. John Jessen devised and ran a program of brutal interrogation techniques for the CIA, based on their own poorly evidenced theories of what works. The HIG's chief researchers were particularly interested in Britain, whose counter-terrorist police have earned a reputation for being sophisticated interviewers, partly because the opposite was once true. In 1992, after public inquiries into two miscarriages of justice involving IRA attacks had revealed abusive interrogation practices, Parliament passed laws stipulating all interviews be recorded and making it an automatic right to have a solicitor present. With the option of coercion effectively removed, the British police were forced to think harder about the best way to obtain information from prisoners resistant to giving it. In a minor but significant change, they stopped using the word interrogation with its confrontational overtone and replaced it with interview. The HIG invited Lawrence to apply to them for research funding. I said, I don't want to do research on students. I want to look at the real thing and extract from observation what works. He set his sights on an audacious goal: persuading the National Counterterrorism Unit to give him access to video of its interviews with terrorist suspects. 2 years and over 100 phone calls later, in 2012, he secured an appointment with the officer in charge of interviewing. Lawrence told him that by studying his team's methods, he could establish definitively which tactics were effective and which were not. He also offered to use the resulting evidence base to design training that would hone the skills of even specialist interviewers. The officer listened, and following a negotiation over terms, granted access to 181 interviews, a total of 878 hours of tape. Further interviews were shared with the Allisons later, including the one I was allowed to view. They included Irish paramilitaries, Al-Qaeda operatives, far-right extremists, incompetent bunglers caught up in something they didn't understand, and highly dangerous operatives. The tapes were housed in a secure police facility in Yorkshire, and the Allisons were not permitted to move them. They took turns to visit, often accompanied by a research assistant, Stamatis Elntib. The police officer assigned to monitor them that day would meet them at the door, then sit with them in the small viewing room as they watched hours of video. After a full day of this, whichever Allison was on duty would check into the nearby Premier Inn, sleep, and return to the facility in the morning for another day's work. Each interview had to be minutely analysed according to an intricate taxonomy of interrogation behaviours developed by the Allisons. Every aspect of the interaction between interviewee and interviewer, or interviewers, sometimes there were two, were classified and scored. They included the counter-interrogation tactics employed by the suspects, complete silence, humming, the manner in which the interviewer asked questions, confrontational, authoritative, passive, the demeanour of the interviewee, dominating, disengaged, and the amount and quality of information yielded. Data was gathered on 150 different variables in all. Watching and coding all the interviews took 8 months. When the process was complete, Lawrence passed on the data to Paul Christiansen, a colleague at Liverpool University, who performed a statistical analysis of the results. The most important relationship he measured was between yield, information elicited from the suspect, and rapport, the quality of the relationship between interviewer and interviewee. For the first time, a secure, empirical basis was established for what had, until then, been something between a hypothesis and an insider's secret. Rapport is the closest thing interrogators have to a truth serum. In 1943, Major Sherwood Moran of the US Marines published a memorandum on the interrogation of enemy prisoners of war and distributed it to troops throughout the Pacific Theater. Moran was a missionary who had raised a family in Tokyo before the war. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor in 1941, he was 56 and living in Boston. Realizing that his fluency in Japanese language and culture might be helpful to the American war effort, he joined the Marines. Moran soon became known as an unusually effective interrogator of Japanese soldiers who were famously resistant interviewees. Like Islamist terrorists today, the Japanese were fanatically, suicidally committed to their cause and deeply hostile to Americans. In his memo, Moran explained why he eschewed the bullying methods used by other interrogators. He believed that if the prisoner was forcibly reminded he was facing his conqueror, he would be placed in a psychological position of being on the defensive. Moran's premise was that even the most implacable prisoner had a story that he wanted to tell. The interrogator's job was to create an atmosphere in which he felt willing and able to tell it. The surest way to do that is to treat him as a fellow human being, rather than an enemy. Make him and his troubles the center of the stage, not you and your questions of war problems. If he is not wounded or tired out, you can ask him if he has been getting enough to eat. If he is wounded, you have a rare chance. Begin to talk about his wounds. Ask if the doctor has attended to him. Have him show you his wounds or burns. Moran did not believe in making the prisoner feel scared or powerless. Stripping a prisoner of his dignity merely reinforced his determination not to speak. The aim should instead be to get into his mind and heart, to achieve intellectual and spiritual rapport. Today, most experienced interrogators agree. In 2012, the psychologist Melissa Rossano asked 42 U.S. interrogators what they believed made for successful interviews. The participants, who responded anonymously, had performed interrogations in Afghanistan and Iraq with some of the most hardened and resistant interviewees in the world. These are some of their responses. Being nice is far and away going to be more fruitful than being an asshole. I could scare the crap out of you in the next 10 seconds if I really wanted to, but you know, what's that going to do? You have to present a very empathetic, supportive environment. Rapport is what we do. I was trying to think of why I've had success, or we as a team have had success with these guys, and I think in some respect that they are interested to tell their story. They're interested to tell the why. So I think talking to them in a way that is non-judgmental gets results. For most of its history, interrogation has been entwined with accusation and retribution. In 16th century Europe, it was used to justify the trial and execution of women accused of witchcraft. Suspects would not avoid torture until they stopped lying and confessed the truth, that is, confessed to whatever wildly implausible crime with which their interrogators arraigned them. The accusations were contrived to resolve communal grievances or satisfy public hunger for justice, however rough. Interrogation was revenge, disguised as truth-seeking. Today, interrogations still get framed as accusatory moral dramas, and not just on TV. American police officers are trained in the Reed technique, developed in the 1950s by John Reed, a former Chicago cop. In a pre-interrogation interview, the detective assesses a suspect's credibility by observing his body language, such as fidgeting or eye movements. There is no evidence these are reliable cues to deceit. Once he decides that a suspect is lying, the interrogator moves into confrontational mode in an effort to break the suspect's resistance. The technique has been consistently associated with false confessions. It survives, at least in part, because it makes the interrogator feel in control, positioning him as a heroic protagonist. Accusatory models of interrogation lay great emphasis on body language, partly because the hostile interviewer has already cut off his richest source of information. Words. Aggression kills dialogue, as other participants in the Rossano study attest. Screaming and yelling puts up a wall. Playing the bad cop doesn't work. Being nasty, being confrontational, pounding the desk, throwing things, calling the person names, just anything that you would expect that would just turn somebody off from wanting to talk to you. Despite its reputation among elite practitioners, rapport has been vaguely defined and poorly understood. It is often conflated with simply being nice. Lawrence Allison refers to this derisively as the cappuccinos and hugs theory. In fact, he observes, interviewers can fail because they are too nice, acquiescing too quickly to the demands of a suspect, or neglecting to pursue a line of purposeful questioning at a vital moment. The best interviewers are versatile. They know when to be sympathetic, when to be direct and forthright. What they rarely do is impose their will on the interviewee, either overtly through aggression or covertly through the use of tricks, techniques of unconscious manipulation which make the interviewer feel smart but are often seen through by interviewees. Above all, rapport, in the sense used by the Allisons, describes an authentic human connection. "You've got to mean it," is one of Lawrence's refrains. The Allisons named their research project ORBIT, Observing Rapport-Based Interpersonal Techniques. Part of its purpose is to provide an anatomy of rapport, the better to understand what creates and destroys it. At the heart of the Allisons' model is an insight from a neighbouring field. During the years when she worked on police cases with Lawrence, Emily Allison had come to see interrogation as a close relation of addiction counselling. Both involve getting someone who does not want to be in the same room as you to talk about something they do not want to talk about. Around 2 decades ago, the practice of addiction counselling was transformed by the application of a simple principle. Patients should feel responsible for their choices. Emily wondered if it wasn't time for interrogation to catch up. In 1980, a 23-year-old South African called Stephen Rolnick started work as a nurse's aide in a rehabilitation centre for alcoholics. The clinicians shared a confrontational approach to the job. They believed their clients were lying to themselves and others about the severity of their problem. Before setting the patient on the road to recovery, the clinician needed to challenge the patient on their dishonesty and strip away their illusions to break their resistance. This clinic was hardly atypical. The post-war medical consensus on addiction treatment regarded patients as wayward children who needed to be taught how to behave. The counsellor's job was to tell the addict the truth about their condition and, if they denied it, to do so again more forcefully until they accepted it. To Rolnick, this seemed bound to poison the relationship. In the coffee room, he observed that the off-duty conversations of the counsellors were imbued with disdain for their patients. One of the clients under Rolnick's care was an alcoholic called Anthony, who would leave group sessions having barely said a word. One day, he walked out for the last time. Rolnick discovered the next morning that Anthony had shot his wife and then himself in front of their young children. Shattered, Rolnick resigned from the centre, left South Africa, and settled in the UK, where he embarked on a course in clinical psychology at Cardiff University. A couple of years in, Rolnick came across a new paper written by a young American psychologist called William Miller and was startled by how much he agreed with it. Miller argued that counsellors were having precisely the wrong kind of conversation with their clients. Addicts were caught between a desire to change and a desire to maintain their habit. As soon as they felt themselves being judged or instructed, they produced all the reasons they did not want to change. That isn't a pathology, Miller argued. It's human nature. The more we feel someone trying to persuade us to do something, the more we dwell on the reasons we should not. By insisting on change, the counsellor was making himself feel better, while reinforcing the addict's determination to carry on. Miller argued that rather than instigating confrontation, counsellors should focus on building a relationship of trust and mutual understanding, enabling the patient to talk through his experiences without feeling the need to defend himself. Eventually, and with the counsellor gently shaping the dialogue, the part of the patient that wanted to get better would overcome the part that did not, and he would make the arguments for change himself. Having done so, he would be motivated to follow through on them. Miller called this approach motivational interviewing, MI. Rolnick used Miller's method in his clinical practice with encouraging results. On meeting Miller at a conference, he told him about his enthusiasm for MI. The two men wrote a book together, developing the ideas in Miller's paper. Motivational interviewing revolutionized the field of counseling and therapy, and its techniques became widely practiced. Empirical studies found MI to be a far more effective treatment than traditional methods. Implicit in Miller and Rolnick's critique of traditional counseling was the uncomfortable suggestion that counselors should turn their professional gaze upon themselves and question their own instinct to dominate. Instead of thinking of himself as an expert sitting in judgment, the counselor needed to adopt the more humble position of co-investigator. As Miller put it to me, the premise is not, "I have what you need, let me give it to you." It's, "You have what you need, and we'll find it." The patient must feel autonomous, the author of their own actions. Emily Allison, who had trained in MI while working as a counsellor for the probation service in Wisconsin, noticed that interrogations failed or succeeded for similar reasons as therapeutic sessions. Interrogators who made an adversary out of their subject left the room empty-handed. Those who made them a partner yielded information. The best ones suspended moral judgment and conveyed genuine curiosity. She concluded that the detainee, like the addict, wants to feel free, despite or rather because of their confinement, and that the interviewer should help them to do so. The Allison's analysis of the terrorist tapes confirmed this. One of their most striking findings is that suspects are likelier to talk when the interviewer emphasizes their right not to. The more pressure you put on a person, the less likely they are to speak to you. You need to make them feel responsible for their choices, said Lawrence. You can't bullshit. You've got to mean it. He slips into character. Ian, you don't have to speak to me today. Whether you do or not isn't up to me. It isn't up to your solicitor. It's up to you. These are powerful tools to get inside someone's head, said Lawrence. But they're not tricks. You have to be genuinely curious. There's a reason this person has ended up opposite you, and it's not just because they're evil. If you're not interested in what that is, you're not going to be a good interrogator. Within a 2-week stretch early in the summer of this year, Manchester and London were struck by terrorist attacks. In the days that followed, there was an urgent push to uncover any networks in which the perpetrators, now dead, were enmeshed. Anyone who had been in contact with them needed to be rung for information. The burden of that task fell to a select group of specialist interviewers drawn from counter-terrorist units across the country. Something they had in common is that they were all alumni of the Alcyon course, an intensive 6-day workshop designed by the Allisons in partnership with the police. More than 150 officers have now taken the course, which a counter-terrorist officer told me was by far the best interrogation training the police have ever had. At the heart of the Alcyon course is a series of role-play exercises. Actors from a company called Characters, which specializes in professional role-playing, take the parts of interviewees. The roles might include a gang boss with ties to terrorists, or a young woman who has been sharing extremist propaganda on social media. The attendees are sent into the room with instructions to elicit specific information. They are told something about the suspect, but they don't know what kind of character they are about to interview. It might be someone sullen or monosyllabic, fiercely belligerent, or charming but evasive. The simulations are intended to be as testing as possible. We wanted to create something harder than the real world, says Lawrence. The actors, who have done the course many times, are now highly experienced interviewees and expert at needling, provoking, or eluding their inquisitors. As soon as an encounter begins, its fictional nature is almost completely forgotten. Even veteran interviewers can be pushed to the edge of self-control. Course facilitators, observing from outside the room, intervene when necessary. Sometimes we design a character that will press the buttons of that particular person, says Lawrence. We want to see if they can emotionally self-regulate under pressure. Simply put, can they stop themselves losing it? Studies of interrogation are often preoccupied with the question of how to detect deception, but even a lie is information. The hard problem for an interrogator is a suspect who says nothing. As one counter-terrorist officer who worked with the Allisons told Lawrence, I don't care if they're lying, I just want them to talk. Terrorists can say nothing in a variety of ways. Irish paramilitaries were trained to focus their gaze on a spot on the wall and remain utterly silent. Some suspects give only monosyllabic answers or stick to scripted responses, or simply turn their chair around, presenting the interviewer with the back of their head. Lawrence demonstrated this to me, even in the context of make-believe. It was deeply unsettling. Islamic extremists, like Diallo, are prone to long ideological rants. All such tactics have the potential to be doubly effective because they get under the skin of the interviewer, throwing him off his plan by goading him into anger. On the opening day of the Alcyon course, Lawrence introduces the research and gives a crash course in interpersonal psychology, which is concerned with communication and how it breaks down. An interviewee, who might be hostile, cooperative, terrified, or some combination of the above, exerts an emotional force on the interviewer that is hard to resist. Skilled interrogators are adept at managing their own automatic responses, like sailors able to ride the sudden swells of a choppy sea. The premise of interpersonal psychology is that in any conversation, the participants are asking for status, to feel respected and listened to, and communion, to feel liked and understood. Power, love, says Lawrence, the fundamental elements of all human behaviour. Conversations only go well when both parties feel they are getting their fair share of each. A father who opens the door to his daughter when she comes home late might adopt a confrontational style, implicitly inviting a contrite response. But his daughter, feeling her agency being denied, pushes back, which provokes her father's anger. A power struggle ensues until the conversation terminates with one or both stomping off to their bedroom. If the father had emphasized his love for his daughter, a conversation about acceptable norms might have developed. But doing so isn't easy, partly because children know exactly which buttons to press. I tell the police, if you can deal with teenagers, you can deal with terrorists, says Lawrence. As we were talking, Lawrence stepped into role, pointing at my notepad. Can I have that? Instinctively, I shook my head. Why not? Give me a couple of sheets of paper. I declined. Come on, are you fucking joking? I felt trapped, unable to think of a reason not to give him paper, but unwilling to back down. Giving it to him felt like a small humiliation. It's a classic test of autonomy, explained Lawrence. People don't like being controlled, and sometimes they put something in the room like, I want a notebook, to disrupt the balance of power. If you don't deal with it, it becomes a roadblock. So either give him the paper or explain why you won't. An interview fails when it becomes a struggle for dominance, in which the interviewee's way of asserting himself is to tell his interviewer nothing. In a tug of war, the harder you pull, the harder they pull, says Lawrence. My suggestion is, let go of the rope. I thought back to how Diallo's second interviewer had opened him up. Only you know these things, Diallo. If you are willing, you'll tell me. And if you're not, you won't. I can't force you to tell me, I don't want to force you. I'd like you to help me understand. Would you tell me about what happened?
For more Guardian long reads in text and a selection in audio, go to theguardian.com/longread or find us on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/theguardianlongread.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.